Well, I'm very pleased indeed to welcome Dr. Marth Theodore to OCHS, who's a familiar face here. You were here a few years ago with us, and you, since then, you've done a PhD at Haifa University, where you're based, really. And
I was based there. Now let's see where fate will take me.
Oh, okay. And you're currently a visiting fellow at Clare Hall and in the Divinity Faculty at Cambridge.
Yes, exactly.
Where you've been for this year, a visiting scholar for this year. And Theodore's done work on the Bhagavata Purana, and today he's going to talk about also comparative theology, but today he's going to speak particularly on the Parinaman aesthetics underlying the Bhagavata Purana, which I'm very interested to hear about. So we'll pass it over to you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. First of all, I'm happy to be back home.
Yes. Back home, yeah. And just some good news for yesterday evening. I'm working on my Bhagavad Gita translation commentary for years and developing it. So just last evening I got a message from Ashgate that they want to publish it and to send me a contract.
Okay.
And actually, you encouraged me to speak with them years ago, so thank you. And
so
it seems that it's moving. Thank you. This paper, which I'm to discuss, was published in Asian Philosophy, and I dedicated this this paper to the memory of Freedom Hardy, who actually I was inspired by him. I met him during the work. Some of his ideas are here. It's not published in the paper itself. I asked them to put it. Said yes, no. So the bottom line, it's not in print, but it is a paper dedicated to Fred Hardy. Okay. The Parinama aesthetics as underlying the Bhagavata Purana. So first, we'll discuss the influence of the Rasa school on the Bhagavata Purana. The Bhagavata Purana is a medieval Sanskrit text, presumably 9th century CE, and is considered to be one of the most sacred texts for some of the major Vaishnava denominations. It contains 335 chapters and propounds the divinity of Krishna, a theme expressed in a rather personal manner. The Bhagavata Purana combines Vedantin philosophy, dramatic and aesthetic elements, and personal expressions in a unique fashion, so much so that it is considered one of the foremost Hindu scriptures. The question arises whether the dramatic and aesthetic elements in the Bhagavata Purana are circumstantial, or whether their source could be traced and an underlying doctrine pointed at. This paper suggests that there indeed is a dramatic and aesthetic theory underlying the Bhagavata Purana, and that is the Rasa theory ascribed to Bharat. As this tradition went through a split during the Middle Ages, this paper suggests that the Bhagavata Purana's underlying version of the Rasa school is closer to that of Bhoja of Dhara than to that of Abhinavagupta. First, the Bhagavata Purana is an opus universale. The Bhagavata Purana is a product or outcome of the process of Sanskritization of the new Bhakti religion and the popular Krishna legends. The newly emerging Bhakti movement was in need of legitimization and orthodox acceptance, and thus associate itself with the Upanishadic literature, otherwise known as Gyana Kanda, portion of the Veda. In general, Sanskritization refers to a process in the Indian civilization in which a person or a group consciously relates himself or itself to an accepted notion of true and ancient ideology and conduct. The Bhagavad Purana Sanskritization was very unique in that in its usage of an archaic language which already in the 5th century BCE stood in need of a glossary. As such, in the period when the usage of Sanskrit was declining, the Bhagavata Purana consciously attempted to associate itself with the Sanskrit literature and tradition. Thus, did the young and popular Bhakti movement associate itself with ancient and respectable Upanishadic tradition. The union of both traditions verily bore an impressive fruit, the Bhagavata Purana. The Bhagavata Purana's period of composition was extremely flexible and undefined, and as such, southern and northern trends of thought and intellectual traditions merged to form various doctrinal and scriptural innovations. Later, this ferment calmed down, and the consolidating influence of Vedanta in the South encouraged the developments of more sober schools such as Advaita Vedanta and Vishishta Advaita. The second half of the first millennium CE was characterized by a very fertile and multifarious encounter between the two cultures, the Tamil and the Sanskritic. Simplifying issues, the northern Sanskritic culture contributed the Vedic ideology and religion, whereas the southern Tamil culture contributed an emotional type of religion and southern poetical genres. The Bhagavad Purana represents an attempt to integrate north and south, in regards to which writes Freedom Hardy. The Bhagavata Purana tries to integrate all four complexes, and it uses the symbol of the Vedas to achieve this, while adopting the Puranic literary form. Thus, as authors have time and again pointed out, the Bhagavata Purana stands quite apart from other Puranas. It is an opus universale, attempting to encompass everything. That's Hardy. Hardy points to the Bhagavata Purana's attempt to syncretize northern and southern culture and ideology. Moreover, for the purpose of integration, the Bhagavata Purana used the symbol of the Vedas. Thus, he considers the Bhagavata Purana to be unique and to stand quite apart from other Puranas by being an opus universale, i.e. attempting to encompass everything. The question may be raised, is it possible that such a complex, sophisticated, and theologically significant text would on the one hand treat the orthodox sources with such a profound level of scholarship by writing the entire text in a Vedic archaic style and then treat its aesthetic aspects in a rather simplistic style? Could it be that the authors of the Bhagavata Purana absorb not only a philosophical orthodox tradition but an aesthetic orthodox tradition as well? Could it possibly be that in attempting to encompass everything, northern and southern, considering the process of Sanskritization and being of great aesthetic and poetic sensibility, it has assimilated the classical Sanskritic aesthetic tradition originating from Bharat, which is considered traditionally to have a Vedic origin, descending from the god Brahma? Considering the Bhagavad Purana's nature as an opus universale and its passion for orthodox ingredients, it would have been surprising had this not happened. In other words, it may well be that the northern Sanskritic culture had made not only an ideological contribution accompanied by a social system, but an aesthetic contribution by which the Rasa tradition became one of the Bhagavata Purana's building ingredients. When read as a meeting place of these two great orthodox traditions, the Vedic Upanishadic and the aesthetic, the Bhagavata Purana structure as a coherent theological treatise comes to light, and it appears to be a theological magnum opus, taking its point of departure, the Upanishadic moksha, and gradually leading its devoted reader further into the realm of total and personal self-surrender and passionate devotion through an aesthetic development. Once read in that way, the Bhagavata Purana is seen to have a unified theological structure warranting its unique position as one of India's greatest theological treatises, expressing a unique literary genre of aesthetic Vedanta. Are we not imposing a dramatic character on the Bhagavata Purana, which is a Vaishnava theological scripture? Although many studies of Vaishnavism and Krishna Bhakti do not refer to their dramatic nature, it still seems that Vaishnavism is by nature more dramatic than it is generally thought to be. Besides, it has long been associated with dramaturgy, and it may well be that the Bhagavata Purana represents one of the peaks of this phenomenon. A deep look into the nature of Vaishnavism in general and Krishnaism in particular reveals that these are characterized by the presence of a large number of dramatic elements. These are highly significant for devotion and indicate how pervasive drama, both as a concept and as a religious practice, has been in Krishna worship in general. It may well be that the large number of dramatic elements in Krishnaism hint at their archaic nature, and that the association of Krishnaism and dramaturgy may precede the compilation of the Bhagavata Purana by a millennium or so, going as far as saying that there was a flourishing tradition of vernacular Krishna dramas in ancient Mathura as early as the 2nd century BCE. Norwin Hine highlights the relations of Vaishnavism and dramaturgy and his discovery of several different theatrical styles that have grown up around the figures of Rama and Krishna leads him to go as far as saying that our many evidences of drama among the Vaishnavas indicate the existence of a strong sectarian theater and a possibility that fondness for the stage was a special Vaishnava characteristic. Donna Wolf joins Hine in claiming the centrality of dramaturgy in Krishna worship and the spread of this phenomenon far beyond the area of Raj to much of the Indian subcontinent. So it may well be that drama has been closely associated with Vaishnavism right from its formative years, some 2,000 years ago or more. The question may be raised, is there any fundamental principle in Vaishnava theology that encourages the development of dramaturgy? Wolf points at the avatar theme to be such a possible theological source, having its roots already as early as the Bhagavad Gita, and I quote. We begin with the famous lines in the Bhagavad Gita 4:59 that provide the earliest account of Krishna's many births. The forms that the Lord assumes here are there said to be fundamentally different from his true nature, for he is eternal and unborn. The parallel with actors who assume roles for a specific time, a parallel that is merely suggested here, is strengthened by the dramatic scene described in the 11th chapter, in which Krishna first reveals to Arjuna his awesome cosmic form and then assumes once more his gentle appearance as Arjuna's charioteer. Before Krishna resumes his human guise, however, Arjuna apologizes profusely for treating him as a friend, that is, for mistaking Krishna's temporary semblance for his true reality. End quote. The Bhagavata Purana contains numerous examples as to the dramatic nature of the various avatars. Just to name a few, one could think of the appearance of the fish avatara, who asked Satyavrata for protection, but then grew and grew very quickly. The creation of Brahma out of the lotus stem rooted in Vishnu's navel. The story of Vamana, who begged only 3 steps of land from Bali, but soon covered the entire universe. The lifting of Mount Govardhan by Krishna. The rescue of Prahlada by Nrisimha, who killed Hiranyakashipu while adhering to Brahma's curse. And the story of Ajamila, calling upon his son Narayana at the time of his death, but then being sent Vishnu's and Narayana's messengers. The term avatara is closely related to the term lila, which represents a cosmic drama. A general translation of the word would be play, referring to both meanings of the term, and as such, Krishna's lila is both a dramatic performance as well as an expression of his playful and joyous nature. In regards to Krishna's lila, David Haberman writes that this exemplary historical event is recorded in scriptures, particularly in the Bhagavata Purana, in the form of a narrative. The narrative relates the entire life of ultimate reality in its highest personal form, the coward Krishna. Yeah. Haberman highlights the role drama occupies in Vaishnava soteriology through the avatar theme. It provides humans with a model for perfection. In other words, experiencing the dramatic reality revealed by the avatar in this world and depicted in scriptures such as the Bhagavata Purana is the method for attaining perfection. Having once achieved perfection, one practices eternally in those dramatic performances with Bhagavan in the eternal world. A term common to the Vaishnava Puranas is lila, which designates the Lord's play, the spontaneous, unfettered activity manifested in each of his avatars, but expressed most fully in the playfulness of Krishna. The question may be raised as to why the term lila is expressed most fully in the playfulness of Krishna. In order to answer that, the logic underlying the Bhagavata Purana's aesthetic paradigm may have to be uncovered first. But it may well be that the role of Krishna is the most complex and richest in aesthetic terms, i.e. that it displays and attracts the finest, richest, and most complex notions and arouses the same in his worshippers, followers, and devotees. But not only is Vaishnavism in general and Krishnaism in particular associated historically with dramaturgy, and not only does Vaishnava theology contain clear dramatic elements, but the Puranas as a whole are dramatic by nature, so much so that neglecting to recognize the Puranas' dramatic nature may pose a problem for the readers, who in the absence of such recognition may fail to understand them. Freda Machette comments, quote, "A problem arises not from the Puranas' statements about themselves, but from their present existence imprinted and bound editions. In this form, they give the impression of being books intended for reading, commentary, and annotation, but originally they would have been more accurately described as performances intended to be seen, heard, and enjoyed. Unless some appreciation of this is present, today's reader of the Puranas fails to understand them. End quote. Bachet raises an essential question, which is how should the Puranas be read? Apparently, they are meant to be enacted and performed rather than studied as books of knowledge. The Vishnu Purana, which in some ways is quite similar to the Bhagavata Purana, and which also narrates the life story of Krishna, has clear dramatic aspects. An example is the episode where Krishna assumes the role of Mount Govardhan. According to Wolff, the Vaishnava dramatic tendency reaches one of its peaks in the Bhagavata Purana. Quote, "It is in the Bhagavata Purana, however, that the theme of Krishna's paradoxical assumptions of roles is developed most fully. The author of the Bhagavata continually juxtaposes Krishna's cosmic reality with his human form and indicates at various points that Krishna is wholly conscious of his true nature. His human actions are thus necessarily represented as play acting." End quote. Here Wolff explains the Bhagavata Purana's central position among the Puranas. A possible reason for that is that the theme of Krishna's dramatic character is developed most fully in it. Besides the term Lila, the term Maya also needs to be looked into, as it also holds an important role in the Bhagavata Purana's theology. Its significance lies in a somewhat distant or critical perception of reality, resembling a dramatic performance taking place on the world's stage. The spectator is beholding the divine play revealed to him or her through the Bhagavata Purana. The play describes Bhagavan descending to deliver the souls captured in the material world, the observer being one among them. At the same time, by hearing and envisioning the story and the play, the spectator makes progress towards liberation. As such, the term Maya has also a dramatic flavor in the Bhagavata Purana, as opposed to a more scholastic one in other traditions or texts. In summary, the Krishna tradition is by nature dramatic, and that dramatic nature is represented in core Krishnite texts such as the Bhagavad Gita and the Bhagavata Purana. The Vaishnava mode of textual dramaturgy is somewhat complex. The texts themselves are not explicitly considered dramaturgical, but still carry dramaturgical features. Not only is the reader or hearer of the story a spectator in a dramatic performance, but a participant observer too. In other words, when the story speaks of the Supreme Person descending to the world in various avatar forms for the purpose of delivering those jivas deluded by Maya and suffering in samsara, it is the spectators who apparently are those jivas. And when the text tells the stories of Bhagavan, which are meant for the deliverance of the world, the audience is to be delivered too. So in that sense, the enactment of the Bhagavad Purana doesn't really take itself as fictitious, but rather as grounded in reality. By now, it may be quite clear that the Bhagavata Purana has a notable dramatic character. This section will highlight the Bhagavad Purana's compatibility with the Rasa theory of Bharat, as interpreted by the medieval king Bhoja. First, quoting David Shulman, it is to be noted that in many ways, both in individual passages and on the level of its general plan and tone, the Bhagavata seems closer to Kavya than to Purana. That's David Shulman. This poetic nature reflects upon the Bhagavata Purana's concept of bhakti, and as such, devotion in the Bhagavata Purana is often described as conveying the sentiment of bhakti or bhakti rasa. Examining devotion in the Bhagavata Purana, Noel Sheth notes that, quote, "When we turn to the Bhagavata Purana, we find that it is literally saturated with devotion. Every page drips with the juice rasa." It's in the source of devotion. Sheth points to the Bhagavata Purana's abundance of bhakti rasa, saying that it is distinguished by its variety, elaborateness, and intensity. He goes on to analyze various types or modes of devotion, among them Dasya, serving Krishna as a servant, Sakya, friendship with Krishna, Vatsalya, parental affection toward Krishna, and lover-beloved relationship with Krishna. Although Sheth mentions these terms and analyzes them, he doesn't link them directly to Sanskrit poetics. It is generally accepted that the Rasa Lila chapters represent the Bhagavata Purana's climax or peak, and that the gopis' love for Krishna represent the highest spiritual achievement. According to Vaishnava theology, Gavin Flood elaborates on this issue and takes the matter of the Bhagavata Purana's relation to Sanskrit poetics a step further. I quote. That's from Introduction to Hinduism. Although much of the Bhagavata Purana contains references to Krishna's love play with the gopis, it does not mention by name Radha, who only appears with Gita Govinda and in later literature or visual art. In Vaishnava mythology, she is an older married woman, and the love between her and Krishna is conventionally adulterous. This is theologically important and relates to a distinction in Sanskrit poetics between love and union, svakya, one's own woman, associated with marriage, and love and separation, parakya, another's woman, associated with adulterous love. In loving Krishna, Radha disobeys wifely duty, Sri Dharma, for the love of God transcends social obligation. The love between Radha and Krishna is love and separation, characterized by longing, as the soul's longing for the Lord is the highest human spirituality. End quote. Flood considers Radha's romantic love for Krishna to represent the highest human spirituality in Vaishnava theological terms. This assertion is based upon a relation between Vaishnava theology and Sanskrit poetics and seems to justify the mode of romantic love as being higher than other modes of devotion. We may ask, what is this relation? Is Vaishnava theology related to Sanskrit poetics? Could such a relation be articulated in a way that could possibly explain how the gopis' love for Krishna is the highest human spirituality? Hence, as to the relation of the Bhagavata Purana to the Rasa school may also be found in the text itself, beginning with the Bhagavata Purana's three introductory verses. The Bhagavata Purana opens with the aphorism Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya, translated as I offer my obeisance unto Sri Krishna, son of Vasudev, who is the Supreme Person. This is followed by the aphorism Janmadyasya Itaha, translated as from whom emanates the creation and so forth, I maintenance and destruction of the universe. This quotation from the Brahma Sutra 112 points to the Supreme or to Brahman as the source of the entire universe, thus indicating affiliation with the Vedanta school. The first three verses are quite condensed and carry a significant conceptual weight. They end with a statement, Pibata Bhagavatam Rasamalayam Muhuraho Rasika Bhuvi Bhavukaha, translated as, O connoisseurs of rasa, always relish this treatise of the Supreme Person, which is full of rasa, on this earth and in the final state. Bhagavad Purana 113b. It is significant that the term rasa appears already in the opening stanza, which integrates Vedanta with rasa, as aesthetics would later occupy a major place in the Bhagavata Purana. Moreover, the idea of integrating Vedanta and rasa seems to be central and important enough, so much so that it not only opens the Bhagavata Purana, but concludes it as well. Thus, one of the concluding verses of the Bhagavata Purana's final chapter reads as follows: Sarva Vedanta Saram Hi Shri Bhagavatam Ishyate Tadrasamrita Triptasya Nanyatra Syad Rati Kvachit. That's Bhagavatam 12:13-15. The Bhagavata Purana is considered to be the essence of the entire Vedanta tradition. As such, for one who is satisfied by tasting its nectar-like rasa, there does not exist any other delight elsewhere. Apparently, the Bhagavata Purana's author, or group of authors, were interested in emphasizing this integration of Vedanta and rasa and the formal opening and closing of the treatise, an integration out of which the structure evolves. It seems that many scholars indirectly associate the Bhagavata Purana with the rasa theory, while others are aware of a traditional relation between the two. But the question remains to be asked, what is the relation, or in what way are the two related? The oldest work to mention rasa as a definable aesthetic principle is the Natya Shastra of the legendary Bharat. Consequently, an examination of the rasa theory of Bharat is the starting point for any adventure into an Indian understanding of dramatic experience. It appears that drama in general, and rasa in particular, were related indirectly to theology already in Bharat's time, through claiming to be of a divine origin. The Natya Shastra's theological nature is expressed by its consideration of itself as the fifth Veda, meant for the upliftment of mankind from a lower state, characterized by absorption in pleasure and pain, greed, avarice, jealousy, and anger. The Natya Shastra opens by conveying this idea, I quote, Very long ago, said Bharat, people of this world of pain and pleasure, goaded by greed and avarice, by jealousy and anger, took to uncivilized ways of life. Various lords were ruling. It was the gods among them who, led by Mahendra, approached God Brahma and requested him thus, please give us something which will not only teach us, but be pleasing both to eyes and ears. True, the Vedas are there, but some, like the Shudras, are prohibited from listening to them. Why not create for us the fifth Veda, which would be accessible to all the Varnas? End quote. The idea of the Natya Shastra being the fifth Veda may help to explain how it has intertwined so deeply with Hinduism and why religious dramas became such a central practice within Hinduism, a practice which continues to this very day. Similar to Vedanta, which aspired to transcend the problem of egoism, the Rasa school also had the very same aspiration of transcending egoism through a transformative process. So from Bharat's time onward, the central objective of any drama was to evoke within an audience a particular aesthetic emotional experience known as Rasa that could cope with or transcend the problems of egoism. The topic of Rasa appears in the sixth chapter of the Natya Shastra and is followed by discussion of Bhava, or enacted emotion, which appears in the seventh chapter. In analyzing human nature, Bharat defined 41 different emotional states, or Bhavas. These are divided into 8 primary emotions and 33 secondary emotions. The 8 primary emotions were considered by him to be especially prominent, so much so that while experiencing them, a person forgets everything else. These 8 bhavas are called stain or stai bhavas and are listed as follows: amorous love, rati, laughter, hasa, sadness, shoka, anger, krodha, courage, utsaha, fear, bhaya, disgust, jugupsa, wonder, vismaya. We shall avoid a more detailed discussion of the Natya Shastra, but instead quote Neil Delmonico's summary of the Natya Shastra rasa theory. Quote, the Natya Shastra characterized rasa as the spectators tasting asvada of the primary emotions, sthain, relate to a set of vibhavas, anubhavas, and vyabhichari bhavas, which are parts of a dramatic or poetic presentation. Furthermore, as a tasting, the experience is a pleasurable experience. Secondly, it arises because the emotions represent in drama or poetry are both familiar and fictitious. Drama or poetry is therefore essential to the arousal of rasa. That is to say, rasa is not a quotidian experience. Thirdly, rasa is an experience related to but different from the experience of quotidian emotion, bhava. And finally, it occurs in a spectator who is well-disposed, sumanas. End quote. Stated briefly, rasa is the pleasurable tasting of familiar but fictitious emotions through drama or poetry by a sensitive and well-disposed spectator, and is different from the quotidian experience of emotions. It seems that just as the Indians had been pioneers in articulating systematic grammar, they also made a significant and clearly an early contribution to the articulation of a systematic emotional theory. Although the Natya Shastra wasn't originally associated with any particular religious tradition, it was nevertheless absorbed by the new Indian theologies emerging through the first millennia. The polarization among the Vedantin sects represented by the divergence into Shankara and Ramanuja theological positions was either followed by or occurred at the same period with a parallel polarization in the field of aesthetics, reflecting on the very same issues. Just as the philosophical position of Shankara differed much from the theistic Vaishnava position, similarly, the aesthetic position of Abhinavagupta differed much from Bhoja of the Ras position. The split had the same theme at its core, the impersonal versus personal conception of Brahman, the highest reality. In order to focus on the differences between these two approaches, a comparison of three key issues will be made and its implications highlighted. The issues are, 1, the location of rasa, 2, the ontological status of emotions, and 3, the supreme rasa. We argue that whereas Abhinava's position clearly supports the impersonal position, Bodhi's position clearly supports the personal one. So the first question, who can experience rasa, or where is rasa located? Rasa theorists have been divided on the question of who experiences rasa, although there is an agreement that during a dramatic performance the audience may experience rasa under suitable conditions, there are differing opinions on the question, can the actor experience rasa too? Abhinavagupta refuses to grant the aesthetic or experience of rasa to the actor, as the actor is too involved. Thus, in his system, it is only the spectator who experiences rasa. According to Bodhya, though, every cultured individual, rasika, can experience rasa. The condition of one's inner nature and his mature emotional condition is the determinate factor, regardless of whether a person is a spectator, the poet, or the actor. This discussion has a deep effect on the reading of the Bhagavata Purana. If the Bhagavata Purana is to be read as a cosmic drama, as we propose, both the Supreme Person in his avatar forms, acting as Leela, and the readers playing the role of participant observers, all partake in the experience of rasa. Therefore, according to Bodhya's theory, the readers can relish rasa regardless of their position as participant observers. Their only qualification needed for experiencing the rasa is their being rasika, i.e. sensitive, cultured individuals. I believe that this is the way the Bhagavata Purana was traditionally understood, as a liberating drama meant to release the audience who are in the position of participant observers from samsara. Indeed, the Bhagavata Purana opens by addressing its audience as rasikas and calls them to enjoy the Bhagavata Purana, just as an actor calls the audience to enjoy the drama ahead of him. However, were Abhinava's theory to underlie the Bhagavata Purana, the spectators or readers would have been too involved and therefore excluded from tasting the bhakti rasa, being participants in themselves. Therefore, it seems that Bodhya's position of allowing the experience of rasa to be to the spectator well fits the logic underlying the Bhagavata Purana. Second point of comparison, the ontological status of emotions. Abhinava's position is that the sthayi bhava, primary emotion, is worldly, whereas rasa is not of this world and therefore exists only in art. Whereas the sthayi bhava is the experience of the unconscious latent emotional expressions rising to consciousness in the world of everyday life, rasa is the experience of the unconscious latent emotional impressions rising to consciousness in the controlled and impersonal environment of the theater, and can therefore be tasted only there. For Bodhya, the relations between the sthayi bhava and rasa are developmental. For the examples he gave are the production of juice from sugarcane, oil from sesame, butter from curds, and fire from wood. Therefore, for him, both sthayi bhava and rasa are of fundamentally the same nature, but represent different stages of evolution. This controversy among Indian aesthetes is deeply rooted in theology, concerning the nature of the ultimately real and its relation to the world, writes Habermann. I quote, one group, the Parinamavadins, represented here by Bodhya and Vishwanath, maintain that the world is a transformation or development, parinama, of the ultimate reality, Brahman. Whereas the second group, the Vivartavadins, represented here by Abhinavagupta, hold that the world is a false appearance, Vivarta, of ultimate reality. The Parinamavadins use a symbol of the production of curds or milk to explain the existence of the world, whereas the Vivartavadins favor the analogy of a rope being mistaken for a snake to explain the world's false existence. The perspectives of these two schools on the evaluation of aesthetic experience are clear. Parinamavadins see a developmental relationship existing between art, rasa, and the world, sthayi bhava. ordinary emotions are simply an underdeveloped form of rasa. The Vivartavadins, on the other hand, insist that there is no direct correspondence between art, rasa, and the world, stai bhava. Art totally transcends the emotional experience of everyday life. End quote. Although aesthetics seemed at first to differ from Vedanta, we have returned to the core issues debated among Vedantins, such as the realism or idealism of the world, as seen through a discussion of aesthetics. The Vivartavadins insist that the emotions experienced here in this world are illusory and unessential and must therefore be given up. Contrary to that, the Parinamavadins hold the view that the ordinary emotions experienced in this world are but an underdeveloped form of pure emotions or rasas. Therefore, according to this last view, worldly emotions are to be sublimated and purified. The implication is that when Bhagavan appears in his avatar forms, those who feel for him, and even those who don't encounter him directly, but hear of him through the Bhagavata Purana with an open heart, all experience various emotions towards him. These emotions may appear in various degrees of clarity, but they are nevertheless essential and real. When purified and sublimated by hearing the Bhagavata Purana, they turn into rasas and carry the devotee to the spiritual realm of Vaikuntha, where they can be experienced in a pure and intense form. This form of liberation involves the realization of one's true nature, Svarupa, as an active participant in the eternal Lila of Krishna. Therefore, the reading of the Bhagavata Purana according to Bhoja's Parinamavadin's position again seems to fit the logic underlying the Bhagavata Purana. Third comparison, the Supreme Rasa. We shall now look closer into the question, what is the Supreme Rasa according to the two positions? In articulating the impersonal aesthetic position, Habermann quotes Abhinavagupta's commentary on the Natya Shastra, the Abhinava Bharati. I quote, "Therefore, the Atman alone, possessed of such pure qualities as knowledge, bliss, etc., and devoid of enjoyment of imagined sense objects, is the sthayi bhava of shanta, phurati, etc., which arise and disappear due to the emergence and disappearance of the respective causes, are called sthayi bhavas insofar as they attach themselves for some time to the canvas, wall, in brackets wall, in the form of the Atman, which is of an unchanging nature relative to them. But knowledge of the truth is the canvas behind all emotions, and so it is the most stable of all the sthayi bhavas." End quote. Abhinava considers the essential self, namely the Atman, to consist of Sachit Ananda and to be devoid of enjoyment, of objects external to it. Therefore, the state of experiencing the eight rasas is a state in which the Atman, the essential self, which is unchanging by nature, is still clouded by some illusory variety and distinctness. However, being in its original and pure position of true knowledge, it experiences the bliss of Brahman through Shanta Rasa. In other words, according to Abhinavagupta, Shanta Rasa represents the Atman's essential position. In articulating the personal position, Habermann writes, quote, "Another final reduction of all rasas into one supreme rasa is found in Bhoja's Sringara Prakasha. Therein he writes that, at an initial level, any of the emotions listed by Bharat can become a rasa. He continues to say, however, that finally all rasas are based on a truly central and permanent ego, and it is only by means of their association with the ego that the other emotions are enjoyed as rasa. Hence, all rasas ultimately resolve into this ahankara rasa, which Bhoja calls love, shingara, or prema." End quote. In considering Bhoja's position, it is to be noted that the various 41 emotions all produce rasas. These seem to pertain to the essential self and to be experienced in the Atman's pure and original state. As opposed to the position of Abhinavagupta, Bhoja's position is that the Atman maintains a sense of ego or personal identity in its original and pure state too. This is corroborated by the Vaishnava position of the self maintaining a sense of personal identity even in the liberated state or in Vaikuntha, and experiencing in that state a variety of emotions. Once this emotional reality is established as essential, Bhoja proceeds to analyze it and resolves that Shingara or Prema represents the ultimate rasa, or the Atman's pure state. If the Atman, in its liberated state, lives in the variegated world of Vaikuntha and exchanges various worshipful relationships with the Supreme Person, it may well be that according to Bhoja, love is the highest form of exchange with the Supreme Person. Heyman concludes, Bhoja maintains, that's a quote, that the amorous sentiment originating from the dominant love instinct perpetually associated with the soul and awakened by manifestations of beauty is the ultimate source of all rasas. Thus, it is the only one rasa. We see then that both Abhinavagupta and Bhoja finally reduce all rasas into one single and supreme rasa, which they claim compare to the religious experience of Brahma Svada. End quote. Bhoja's position supports two of the Bhagavad Purana's central themes. First, it rationalizes why the Rasalila episode reigns supreme. As according to Bhoja, Shringara or Prema reigns supreme, the Rasalila episode expressing amorous relations with the Supreme is considered to be the Bhagavad Purana's peak. Second, it supports the idea of maintaining a personal identity after achieving the liberated state. According to Bhoja, all rasas are based on a permanent ego. As this ego is permanent and not lost at the liberated state, it is possible for the Atman to continue and exchange rasas with the Supreme Person after achieving the liberated state. This is a central idea found in the Bhagavata Purana, which depicts the world of Vaikuntha as variegated and full of personal expressions. To the contrary, Abhinava's idea of the Atman being a devoid of enjoyment and being representative of Shanta Rasa in its pure form doesn't seem to underlie the Bhagavata Purana. It deprives the Rasa Lila episode from its supreme position and excludes the Atman from having a sense of permanent ego after liberation. Therefore, it seems that here again Bhoja's position is the one underlying the Bhagavata Purana. Bhoja is no doubt later to the Bhagavata Purana's composition in 2 centuries or so. It may well be that Bhoja's rasa theory was a culmination of a then existing tradition in regards to which writes Sheldon Pollock. He writes, quote, his work would more rightly be viewed as the culmination of a tradition rather than a departure from it. End quote. As such, it may be possible to consider that although the Bhagavata Purana had preceded Bhoja, it may have still absorbed an earlier version of similar ideas. In contrasting the two main rasas of Shanta and Shringara, two extreme aesthetic positions may be found. The Shanta rasa represents a quietening and reposing of emotional expressions, a quietening of the mind, and a cessation of all relationships with other persons. Thus, it follows the Advaitin ideal of reposing personal expressions as a stage higher than ordinary life, leading to the complete rejection of all personal characteristics and mental fluctuations, and merging with the undifferentiated Brahman. On the other hand, the Shringara rasa represents the other superlative, an extreme emotional excitement, a state of ecstatic ferment, and intense relationships with another person. So it follows the Vaishnava idea of intense emotional expressions which are pure and free from egotism, directed towards the Supreme Person. This stage is certainly considered higher than ordinary life, as expressed and exemplified by the Alvars and by the central protagonists of the Bhagavad Purana, the Gopis. The meeting of the Vedanta and Rasa schools may have produced two basic kinds of hybrids. The first emphasized the Atman's being peaceful and serene, whereas the second emphasizes the Atman's intense emotional expression toward the Supreme Person. The first position refers to the Atman as pure consciousness and seems to imply that the Atman does not possess personal characteristics. The second position seems to view the Atman in a more personal manner. If the Atman is exchanging relationships with the Supreme Person in the liberated state while separated from the Pradhana and free from the gunas and from samsara, it may well be that in the theology of the Bhagavad Purana, the Atman is taken to be a person too. As opposed to the Supreme Person, the Atman could be taken as a minute person, defined by his, her, its exchange of pure emotions, i.e. rasas, with the Supreme Person. Is there any clear evidence of the application of the rasa theory in deciphering the Bhagavata Purana? Can a clear association between the rasa theory and the Bhagavata Purana be recognized? Is there any traditional source which claims that the rasa theory actually underlies the Bhagavata Purana? Is there a traditional Vaishnava source which grades different stages from Shanta to Shingara, thus supplying a rationale for analyzing the Bhagavata Purana in that way? The Chaitanya Charitamrita of Krishnadas Kaviraj is a later Gaudiya Vaishnava text composed in the 16th century in Bengali. It analyzes the relations between bhakti and the various rasas and often refers to the Bhagavata Purana as a major source representing exactly that. The work provides a gradation of rasas from Shanta to Shingara along with a rationale justifying this gradation. Thus, although it is a later text, it may be considered a useful source in shedding light on our topic and providing some clues not only as to how the Bhagavata Purana is traditionally understood, but as to its structure and doctrine as well. As the Chaitanya Charitamrita of Krishnadas Kaviraj is a text central to Gaudiya Vaishnavism, we may first look at the relations between Gaudiya Vaishnavism and classical Sanskrit poetics. In general, Gaudiya Vaishnavism, Vaishnava tradition, articulated a theology in which the aesthetic categories of classical poetry, kavya, came to be applied to the articulation of devotional religious experience. That's again from Gavin Flood. So the main Gaudiya Vaishnava theological treatises were written by Goswamis of Vrindavan, who were not only highly orthodox in the sense that they accepted the authority of the Veda, but also included within the category of revelation the Puranas, especially the Bhagavata Purana. It may well be that their interpretation of the Bhagavata Purana was orthodox too, i.e. according to the norms prevailing during their times. Therefore, the association of the Bhagavata Purana and Sanskrit poetics might have been seen as the generally accepted way to understand the Bhagavata Purana. Haberman considers the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu of Rupa Goswami to represent the full flowering of Krishna devotionalism and associates this form of religion closely with the Bhagavata Purana. Quote, although Krishna devotionalism has had a long history in India, the kind of religion represented in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu has many new elements that arise in a unique historical moment. In many ways, the religion presented here is a full flowering of what Friedhelm Hardy calls emotional Krishna Bhakti. This new form of religion is very much associated with the Bhagavata Purana, which introduces passionate emotionalism into the world of intellectual Krishna Bhakti, represented in such texts as the Vishnu Purana. End quote. Haberman considers the Bhagavata Purana not only be closely associated with passionate devotional emotionalism, but considers the seeds or the seminal form of this full flowering to have been carried by the Bhagavata Purana itself. Quote, at least since the time of Sridhar's commentary on the Bhagavata Purana in the 13th century, this text began to be understood as a presentation of the religious life as a relishing of the rasa of an emotional relationship with the Lord. What began in earliest ages in a similar form reached full culmination in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. End quote. Having pointed at the role the Bhagavata Purana has played in carrying the seed of the rasa theology, we may now look more closely into the Chaitanya Charitamrita of Krishnadas Kaviraj. The work depicts the life story of the medieval Bengali saint Sri Chaitanya and is divided into three sections, the Adi Lila, Madhya Lila, and Antya Lila. The chapter under discussion is 19th chapter of the Madhya Lila, in which Chaitanya instructs his disciple Rupa through a metaphor of jiva gardeners. Certain jivas gain the seed of the bhakti creeper. They plant the seed and nourish it through shavana and kirtana, hearing and speaking of or singing of, up to the point at which the tree grows and bears the fruits of prema. The metaphor ends in this way, quote, that's from the Chaitanya Charitamrita. And there he serves that wish wishing tree, and in happiness taste the rasa of the prema fruit. For this is the best of fruits and the highest end of man, before which the four ends of man are like straw. In other words, end quote. In other words, according to this text, the process of bhakti achieves its fructification in tasting prema rasa, or the rasa of love for Krishna. This is considered to be the highest end. Krishna thus goes on to mention various stages of prema and concludes, quote, all these are sthayi bhavas of Krishna bhakti rasa. When the sthayi bhavas are mixed together with vibhava and anubhava, and when mixed with sattvika and vyabhichari bhavas, Krishna bhakti rasa comes about as sweet as nectar to the taste. End quote. Here we see a clear application of the rasa theory components in the Krishnite theology. Now, Krishna thus goes on to analyze bhakti rasa as comprised of two groups, primary or chief rasas and secondary or subordinate rasas. He writes, quote, Shanta, Dasya, Sakya, Vatsalya, and Madhura rasa are the names, and among the rasas of Krishna bhakti, these five are chief: Hasya, Adbhuta, Vira, Karuna, Rudra, Vibhatsa, and Bhaya. These are the seven rasas subordinate to the five kinds of bhakti. The five rasas are sthayi and remain spread in the heart of the bhakta. The seven are secondary and gain their cause as guests. Shanta bhaktas with the nine yogendras and Sanaka and the others, bhaktas of the Dasya Bhava, are his numberless servants everywhere. Sakya bhaktas are Shridama and the rest, and in the city, Bhima and Arjuna. Vatsalya bhaktas were mother, father, and many elders. The bhaktas of Madhura rasa are primary and are the gopis and vraja, the mahishis, the lakshmis, too numerous to count. End quote. This paragraph conveys two ideas important for our discussion. First, it divides the rasas into two groups, primary and secondary. Second, it categorizes the devotees into groups characterized by the primary rasas. All the devotees mentioned are mentioned in the Bhagavata Purana too. Thus, Sanaka and the others are mentioned in the third book of the Bhagavata Purana. The nine yogendras are mentioned in the 11th book. Bhima and Arjuna are mentioned in the first book. The fathers, Vasudeva and Nanda, are mentioned in the 10th book. And so are the gopis. It is evident that Krishnadas considers prema rasa, or love, to be the highest as opposed to shanta rasa. This is further reinforced by his considering bhakti to be exclusive, so much so that in its high stage of prema, knowledge or jnana is rejected. The detailed description of the various rasa theory components doesn't leave much doubt as to his sources. Krishna thus clearly builds upon the classical rasa theory, applying the terms sthayi bhava, vibhava, anubhava, etc. Within a theological context, he divides the rasas into two categories, primary and secondary, a division which may be a Gaudiya innovation, as generally the nine rasas are undivided. He goes on to group the different devotees according to their predominant rasa, and that is another clear link to the Bhagavata Purana, as all the stories of the various devotees mentioned appear therein. Summary. The consolidation of the Bhagavad Purana had occurred in a most flexible period, and it had therefore become an opus universale, syncretizing various literary ingredients. At the same time, the bhakti movement was seeking orthodox acceptance and legitimization through Sanskritizing its literary corpus. Vaishnavism, being dramatic by nature, was in need of an orthodox Sanskritic dramaturgical theory, and Bharat's dramatic theory was a natural and available source. The Rasa school had undergone a polarization between the Vivartavadin and the Parinamavadin positions, and the latter was naturally more compatible with the theistic Vaishnava need. The Bhagavata Purana intertwined Vedanta and aesthetics in a unique way, thereby giving a new meaning to the Upanishadic moksha. The new type of theistic moksha furthered an emotional exchange with the Supreme Person, the peak being the experience of Shingara Rasa. The Bhagavata Purana carried these ideas in a seminal form, and it took the tradition a few hundred years before it was able to theorize these literary occurrences. This was finally done by the Gaudiya Vaishnava theorist in the 16th century. Thank you very much. Thank you.
So, questions, comments?
Just the idea of the Bhagavatam as a dramatic text, which is of course very interesting. But then I'm thinking about some parts of the Bhagavatam which are like the second book, the second canto, which are very very theological, very long philosophical discussions about the Purusha, Mahapurusha, and Paramatma. There's so many chapters, chapter after chapter. How would that fit in the context of having an audience listening to a recitation? Because it seems like more like a mixture of different ingredients rather than a specific dramatic performance, so to speak. How would you integrate that?
Well, basically my argument is concerned with the structure of the Bhagavata Purana. Apparently, and that's what I'm saying, the Bhagavata Purana represents the meeting of Vedanta and the rest of traditions, but there's a lot of Vedantin materials, no doubt. There are, I mean, a lot of philosophical Vedantin, Upanishadic, epic materials. It's all there in the Bhagavata Purana, many ingredients. And as I mentioned here somewhere, although it was composed later, but these ingredients are ancient. But it does give them a dramaturgical twist, a slight twist, which later becomes magnified in the Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition hundreds of years later. That twist is already there. And according to that twist, these knowledge parts become parts of Shantarasa. That's the slight twist, which is later magnified. The twist is that when you have the Upanishadic idea of Brahman and Moksha, that gets a dramatic flavor of Shanta. That's where they meet. And in that sense, in Vedantin terms, Moksha, an understanding of Brahman and merging with Brahman, also in personal terms, is the highest. But that becomes a point of departure for a further increase, which will be aesthetic, and the roots can be found in dramaturgical theories. And then you get a theology which says that the Bhagavata Purana goes beyond the Upanishads, beyond Moksha, to deeper and higher, that you get the whole Gaudiya Vaishnava discourse, which comes later, which will say that the personal realization is far above Brahman. So how is it far? Well, I don't go into that here, but basically I'm trying to, this is part of a larger work, I'm trying to analyze the value of two paradigms, I call it, the knowledge paradigm and the poetical paradigm. And the knowledge leads all the way up to full abstraction, which would be merging with Brahman, the Upanishadic realization. And then the poetical one will take it from there, but go into a different direction. Go into an emotional direction and develop the theme of personhood accordingly, culminating in Shungara, which is somewhere from Bhoja's ideas. And then what you have is that the Bhagavatam is carrying these ideas in a seminal form all the way, and later these become magnified, and then in the 16th century you find that Chaitanya Charitamrita speaking about Bhagavatam and these pranic stories in terms of rasa very clearly, stai bhavas and bhavas, and everything is there. But the Bhagavatam is taking it in a similar form. And if you want it to be a little more dramatic, and I take it in another chapter in that forthcoming book, it seems that this kind of occurrences in the first millennium, in the second half of this first millennium, and then you get Shankara and his philosophy, and the theists are trying to find answers, and it's very difficult because Shankara is very strong. His philosophy is very far-reaching, and it's based very deeply upon the interpretation of the Upanishads in the knowledge paradigm. So first you have Ramanuja, and he's trying to get away from Shankara's grip, and he gets to some extent And he differentiates. He has his Sharira Sharibhava. He differentiates. He puts the personal and the impersonal as two aspects, but he still relies on the same Gyanakanda, Upanishadic sources. He cannot distance himself far enough from that, and still he cannot get far enough from Shankara. Then you get Madhva. He gets further away with his dualism, and he separates it more, and he gets closer, but still he doesn't get far enough. And only when the tradition takes these ideas which are there in the Bhagavad Purana and resorts to rasa, and that comes with the Gaudiyas later, then it can actually distance itself far away, far enough from Shankara and the Advaita Vedanta, and articulate itself in other terms which are there in the Bhagavad Purana and carry through it in a similar form. And if you want to be even more dramatic, because we are discussing dramas, if it's not dramatic enough, we can say that if we go to the 2nd century BCE, at the end of the Maurya rule, there was a Brahminical uprise, which is considered to be one of the more creative eras of Hinduism. Creative in terms of dance and songs and arts and so forth. That was after the Buddhist rule of the Mauryas came to an end, and that was the Shunga dynasty, 185 BCE. And and if you like, in the first in the middle of the first millennium, you can say that Buddhism might have entered Hinduism in a new way, maybe in a subtle way, in all the spirit of north meeting south, and that gave a stimuli to Advaita Vedanta. And the uprise was again like as it was in the 2nd century BC, that you had Buddhists on the one hand, and the artistic expressions as negating Buddhism on the other hand. So you have it here again, the Buddhist ideas carried in a similar way or through Shankara or in some subtle way. And again, the Hindu tradition resorting to aesthetics to differentiate itself from these ideas. So in a sense, the 2nd century BCE is enacted again 1500 years later through a long and dramatic process. So that's to be a little more dramatic about the historical complex,
yeah. I had another point. Can I take it now?
Sure.
Just about the rasa, the understanding of rasa, because you mentioned the Chaitanya Charitamrita as a reference, but then I was thinking that much of that rasa, which is discussed in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, comes really from the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, which is an earlier text.
Yeah.
So I just wonder why you did not refer to the source. As you were discussing the Chaitanya Charitamrita and Rasa Tattva, when not referring to the kind of canonical text of Rasa, which is the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, was there a special?
I took both of them. I in the larger work, I referred to the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu directly quite a bit.
Right.
I went quite a bit. Why here? It was very condensed, and then it gave the point in a few verses. You could have Stai Bhava and Vibhava and all that in very condensed verse. And also in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, you have an interesting rationale pointing at the development between the rasas. It's very nicely explained there how in Shanta you have certain qualities, but then in Dasya you have more. And in Sakya you have more, and in Vatsali you have more, and then in Shingara you have the most. So it's explained there very nicely. But I rely upon both texts, and in larger work, I quote much more the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu than the Chaitanya Charitamrita, because that is the main work, of course.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm reminded of a verse, I think, in the 10th skanda of the Bhagavad Purana. And it's interesting because it ties in with your theory of the different rasas, and it actually describes the murti of Krishna as navarasamai, as if all the nine rasas are sourced from Krishna itself. And as a depiction of that, I think I'm can't remember exactly the episode within the larger chapter. I think it may have been the wrestling match, I think, between one of the Pandavas and one of the Gauru brothers.
And this is the 10th book?
I think it's the 10th chapter, yes, 10th skanda, 10th book, yes.
Chandura and Mushtika,
I can't remember exactly. I'm quite sure it's the 10th book, I'm not certain.
Be interested to have the exact verse.
Yeah, I can remember the ending of the last verse. It's Tattam Yoginam Param. That's all I can recall. But it's very nice because they show Krishna just entering the arena. And all these rasas is replete with all these different rasas, and the different, you talk about the rasagna and the rasiks, the different people who have those emotions within them are evoked by that murti of Krishna.
Right.
And so the gopis,
when he gets into the arena,
and the gopis
see him as Shungara.
Everyone has a different
expression. And the yogis, they see him as Tattam Parinam, Yoginam Param. Kansa sees him as Yam, Bhairas. And his Hasya and Kujupupsa. I think that ties in nicely with all your aspects of Ras and bringing a bang to a personal form.
Thank you very much.
There's been a lot of work then, I think. it's hard to tie in Vedanta and Rasti together because
much of the work was done here in this library, so happy, yeah. This book's
maybe we can experience the Rast then.
I had a question regarding the Parinam and the Vivarta, the discussion on that. And there's no doubt that the Bhagavatam inherits the Parinam from the Vedanta Sutras and like that, but then it uses many of the Vivarta analogies, like the one that you mentioned about the rope and the snake in its text.
Yeah.
So I was just curious as to how, in terms of poetics and these things, you resolve that, because it's not clearly sticking to the Parinam.
It's not clear. There's a lot in the Bhagavata Purana. There's a lot there.
Mm-hmm.
And again, a lot of many materials. I mean, of all sorts. Puranic, Upanishadic, Vedantic, and so forth. And there's no doubt these ideas, these Vivarta ideas, I mean, which you can interpret as Vivarta, but the twist is, and here's the twist, which I'm looking at the whole text, that when the text speaks in these terms, which you take as Vivarta, although probably others could take it differently. I mean, I think about the tradition. I mean, Ramanuja would probably argue that these impersonal, these texts which sees the abstract Brahman as the highest, the Bhagavata Purana would take it as Shantarasa. And that's the connection. that's the twist. These Upanishadic sources are there, these passages are there, no doubt. But in the overall structure, these are taken to be expression of Shantarasa, and from there, the dramatic elements will take it towards, gradually towards Krishna Lila, which will be Shingararasa. So I'm not saying that you don't have these parts, you have it. I mean, it's a puzzle. You have Daniel Sheridan's books. A book about the Advaitic theism of the Bhagavata Purana, and the same question: what do you do with all these Advaita? There's a lot of Advaita in the Bhagavata. I mean, of course, there's a lot, and you can quote all these: the supreme is pure knowledge, and all that. What do you do with all these? And it's a great challenge. I mean, and how do you reconcile these Advaita, these non-dual parts, with the personhood of Bhagavan? I mean, is it a mixture? Do you just have a conglomerate? I mean, you have these parts, and then you have stories, and it's all mingled together. And what I'm saying is that there's a structure which gives a twist to these passages and integrates them within a dramatic theory or structure, which leads one ultimately to the Rasa Lila. And supplies a rationale why the Rasalila is supreme. Otherwise, what's the point? I mean, how can you justify why is the Rasalila supreme? And that's the whole thing with Bhoja's Shingara Prakasha and so forth, that you have Shingara up. And if it was otherwise, then Shanta would have been supreme, mm-hmm. and the Rasa Lila would lead one all the way up to Shanta.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's not that. Don't worry.
Sorry?
Don't worry. That it's not the story. It's not. It doesn't. Yeah, yeah. So it doesn't happen. But that is the the other direction.
Rasa schools as well. For example, Dvani is a very prominent school of poetics and rhetoric. Have you heard of Dvanyalok?
Yeah.
Upon which Abhinav Gupta wrote his Abhinav Lochan, I think, which is commentary. And I think subsequently, right up to the 10th century, many, at least five or six different schools of Rus were propounded by different acharyas.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, there's a very
so
deep,
rich
poetic tradition.
And I'm sure each school probably could read into the Bhagavad and probably give their own. For example, I know because I remember studying some of this for my MA in Sanskrit, which was on poetics. And partly on poetics, sorry. And one school seems to promote Karun Ras above all others, and the highest sort of emotive experience mm-hmm. of the soul is in Karun Ras. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the longing of the soul to join with God.
Yeah.
The separation is because there's no union yet. That longing comes with Karuna, mm-hmm. and Karun, which is the sad part. There's many different schools that where you could look into this in different ways.
Yes, and I also like to make the point that the Bhagavata is very rich, mm-hmm. and the structure allows many points of view. It's not decisive,
mm-hmm.
and as such, historically, you have different commentaries.
Yeah.
You have Sridhar Swami, who's more Advaita in line,
mm-hmm.
to some extent, and you have Jiva Goswami, for example, would be more in this line, and the Bhagavata allows that.
Mm.
It allows all that because it's so divergent and so forth. So certainly it's not that simple. But as far as the structure, I do say that it happened. That's the historical story. The first millennium comes. There's a north and south meeting. There's divergence into Parinama and Vivarta in both Vedanta and in the Rasa traditions. These materials from the Bhagavata Purana, it gets a dramatic twist, it's carried in a seed form, and then gradually the commentators work harder and harder over the years to decipher it, and then around the 16th century, you get the Gaudiya Vaishnavas. I mean, someone told me a few days ago that I'm writing it from a Gaudiya perspective. So I said, not exactly. If you really see what I'm saying that the Gaudiya is the outcome. I'm not coming. Maybe personally, there is something I can't say. But I'm not imposing. I'm not taking the Gaudiya ideas and imposing them to Bhagavatam. Rather, I'm going the other way around. I'm starting from trying to articulate a historical process, and then explain that the Gaudiya is an outcome of that historical process. So I don't know if I'm doing service or disservice to the Gaudiya tradition. But that's what I'm saying. But I'm not coming and imposing it. I'm coming and actually explaining it based on the earlier occurrences.
Interesting.
Well, it's interesting that you get a privileging of the aesthetic over the ethical. I'm thinking, and this, I mean, it must be one of the first times that happens, as the downplaying of the ethical and the highlighting of the aesthetic, which is.
Novel.
It's
not,
yeah,
not strange.
Usually it's the other way around.
Yeah. I
think it means more theological or the philosophical.
Yeah, an emphasis on it, on the ethics.
Rather than
on the aesthetics. So religion is fundamentally not about ethics, but about aesthetic appreciation.
I argue with Geoffrey Purinder, the late great scholar, I consider his arguments from his book Avatar and Incarnation in deciphering the Bhagavata Purana. I have a whole section arguing that. He says something like that it's nice to see Krishna dancing with the gopis and so forth. It kind of brings us a smile. But really, you have to see that the serious business of Krishna this can be seen in the Bhagavad Gita in uplifting Dharma, which is the ethics. Mm. And he certainly takes the ethical aspects to be higher than the aesthetical, which is basically a Western construction of considering knowledge to be higher than emotions. That's so I go with Parinder and I say, what I do is I go to the roots of a Western identity of personhood, and I go to Boethius. And Boethius, defines the person as an individual substance of a rational nature. And I go a little with that and say that I don't know what's Parinder's ideas, but apparently he's a Western thinker, and in that he probably considers the essence of personhood to be rationality. And that goes to medieval thought, and in medieval thought, rationalizing would be a religious activity. I mean, when a person, that's derivative from Greek thought, when a person rationalizes, he comes to contemplate the supreme rational, and there's kind of merging of rationality, and there's a theology is actually a religious activity of rationalization. Anyhow, what I'm saying is that to understand the Bhagavata Purana, I'm saying that you cannot actually impose a Western construction of personhood on the Bhagavata Purana. And if we approach the Bhagavata Purana with this Western construction of personhood, of considering the human being to be essentially a rationality, or to have a reason higher than emotions, it will not work for the Bhagavata Purana. And therefore, I'm offering an alternative construction of personhood, which is part of my book there, in which I'm not leaving rationality as higher than emotions, but balanced, as different components of personhood. And I'm saying that in order to answer Parinder's objection, you have to offer an alternative construction of personhood, and that is different than the Western construction. Although Parinder doesn't speak about his construction of personhood, but I take it that he's speaking from a Western point of view, and therefore you would have a reason above emotions. So I deconstruct that. I offer a different construction, and if anyone is interested, I'm to give another two papers here in Oxford in the next 2 weeks. One is in the Spalding Symposium, but the next day or the day after, I'm not sure exactly, there's a comparative philosophy conference at Wolfson College. No, also I didn't know. Just a few. Martin Owens, he's organizing that. He just, a friend got in touch, and I was in touch with him. Anyhow, he got me in the last moment, so therefore I don't know exactly when my paper is going to be, but I'm going to give a short paper of about 20 minutes, either on Saturday evening or Sunday morning, in comparative philosophy, about comparing these two notions of personhood, Boethius on one hand, and the Bhagavad Purans, which I construct, and trying to evaluate the difference. So the answer is that in the Bhagavad Gita, of course, you'd have ethics above aesthetics. I completely agree. But in the Bhagavata Purana, the way I read it is that there you still have the same Gita materials, but overall you get this aesthetic twist, which pushes it into towards kavya or towards dramaturgy. And if we actually decipher the underlying concept of personhood, that will be different, and that will leave aesthetics and ethics on a similar level. It won't give ethics an advantage, although in the Bhagavad Gita you will have an advantage of ethics, but in the Bhagavad Purana it leans towards aesthetics because of all these ideas.
Presumably, the latest commentators are embarrassed by the whole poetic, the parakya svakya kind of thing. I don't know. So they would, what would be scandalous in a social context becomes transformative and aesthetic context.
Later commentators, you mean the 19th century neo-Hindus?
I don't know. In the I'm sorry about my ignorance of the Gaudiya tradition. Some of the later Goswamis write a commentary on the. You'd have to help me out.
I'm not sure. I didn't get into commentaries.
I think Jiva is taking up that Parakiya Sakya.
Well, he accepted it, didn't he? Was anybody embarrassed by it?
He rejected it, Parakiya.
He rejected it.
He made an argument. As far as I remember, you can correct me.
That's probably what I'm thinking of then.
It's an ocean of interesting material. I mean, just to go to commentaries, it's so much there. But
what's emotion? How would you translate? If you just earlier, I was very interested in what you were saying about right reason and emotion, about which what a person is. What would be a Sanskrit for emotion? Bhava, would that be what you're thinking of? Something like.
I was thinking in Western terms. I didn't get into exact dictionary. Definitions.
Divided person. I mean, certainly in the 18th century, divided person into the faculties of willing, thinking, and feeling. Schleiermacher. Yeah, but certainly in India, you get it divided up in different ways. So you get willing, icha, which has a wider somatic range than will, jnana, thinking, if you like, or cognition. But it's not feeling. They don't have feeling. They have acting.
I start my actually the beginning of the book starts with a discussion of concepts of personhood in the Hindu milieu, and I present three concepts. The first being the Mimamsa, the person as sacrificing, very active, changing the world, controlling the world through sacrifice. The second is the Sankhya notion of personhood. Which is this yogic involution, transcendence, and separating of Prakriti and Purusha. And the third one is the Vedantin notion of personhood, which is, of course, the Atman coming to Brahman in this way or that way. And then I say that one of the goals of this work is to articulate the fourth one, which is missing, and that's the aesthetic self. I call it the aesthetic self of the Bhagavad Purana. Now, I argue that the Bhagavad Purana conveys a fourth definition of personhood, which is different than the working one, I mean the Mimamsa one, different than the yogic Sankhic one, and different from the Vedantin. It's actually aesthetic notion of personhood. And I say that actually these are intertwined. It's not four different people, but all these are intertwined. But the notion itself, if philosophically you want to look into it, you have to separate it and to actually look into its nature, and that's one of the goals of my work.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting you mention that, because I think Schleiermacher emphasizes the intuitive feeling, the faculty of religion being that
creature feeling.
When he talks about it, it's not just a normal emotion, but it's that consciousness, and that's relation between creator-creature. Creature.
Of absolute dependence.
Yes, that's right, exactly. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there must be. That could relate to some rus, maybe.
Of course, yeah.
Emotive
dependence.
Dependence feeding.
Well, that's basically dasya.
Dasya, yeah.
Dasya have dependence.
That's right.
On the Lord, as the protector, the father.
Sharanagati, prapatti, all those aspects sort of come into it.
Yeah, that's dasya basically.
I was thinking, a comment to what you said, because I was trying to look at the verse, but in the 10th canto, Maharaj Parikshit, he asks Sukade Goswami about the question about whether the fact that Krishna was dancing with women would be considered to be moral, and why, and what kind of effect would have in society and things. Mm. And then the answer was that because Krishna was the supreme person, so that was allowed. But for anyone else, wouldn't be considered to be morally correct. So that shows a little bit that reaction. I mean, the kind of the moral question was very much in the mind of the king. So he was kind of wondering himself right there when he was listening to the narration. So it was kind of, is it controversial already?
So it's not
then
a moral exemplar in Krishna.
No, it yeah, exactly. Interesting. Controversial.
Sometimes I have some kind of an historical interpretation, thinking that Hinduism was less, absorbed with the questions, but later under the Muslim rule, it became more puritanical,
mm-hmm.
and apologetic, and always make sure that it's more and more, and then the British rule.
Yes.
But Gaudiya Vaishnava is well into the Muslim rule, that's the 16th century, and of course, it reacts to that. But if you go to 500 or more years earlier, probably the Gupta period, we're not
nobody
that
was
not disturbed about it. Is yeah, mm. it kind of it went more natural with basically Hindu patterns of thought. Yeah,
mm.
and you know, this historical perspective.
Mm.
Well, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Very interesting
discussion.
Thank you.